Hey folks, this is Carrie Arendtke reading Keep Track of Losing Days by Drafter, Chapter 7, Ghosts. So Drafter has been listening and extremely kindly let us know that the notes that we were talking about in Chapter 3, which I think we had like sort of deciphered later on in the voice chat, I think Dana was helping, but the notes mean talk to Jiang Cheng about Jiang Yanli's birthday and Wen Chao, Nightless City, 1 p.m. Saturday. Which, yeah, we I think we eventually got there, but I'm glad to have that confirmed. And thank you for listening. It's very exciting. Okay, Chapter 7, author's notes, and we're back. If you haven't read my updated end notes on Chapter 6 or my Tumblr post regarding this fic, you might want to. And there's that link, and we read the end notes last time. Okay. Wen Ying's last Instagram post was Sunday morning. A shot of the Space Needle disappearing into a bank of fog with the hashtag Summer's Over. Nothing since then on any social media channels. Jiang Guanyin drives to Northgate to see if any of Wen Ying's co-workers have seen or heard from him. Nobody's seen him since Saturday, he texts Wang Ji, heading back now. Wang Ji calls Wen Qing's cell phone a few times, but she doesn't answer. Digging through Wei Ying's phone records, he finds the number for Yuan's grandmother.
Oh, Anying is sick. He has pneumonia, she tells him.
He can hear Yuan's little piping voice in the background, Sing yelling, doot, 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 doot. I took him some soup, but Aqing told me I shouldn't see him because of my asthma.
When was this? Wang Ji asks.
Wednesday, she says. Poor Anying's always been prone to chest colds. It runs in our family. He thanks her and hangs up. On the way to his apartment building, he calls the hospital and asks them to page Dr. Wen. They say she just went off rotation and won't be back until Tuesday. He pounds on her apartment door, but already knows. She's not answering.
He's your cousin's roommate. You don't recognize him?
Ah, yes. How is Wen Qing? Still a bitch? Wen Chao had known, when they spoke to him last night, that Wang Ji and Ye Mingjue had only interviewed Wen Qing, because he knew Wen Ying wasn't there. Oh, I get it. They had only interviewed Wen Qing, because he knew Wen Ying wasn't there. Wen Ying has been missing at least as long as Wei Ying has, possibly longer. The only difference is that nobody's reported it. Wen Qing is in the wind.
Why would she cover for them?
He asks Jiang Wenyin when he gets back from Northgate.
I thought they were estranged from that branch of the Wen family.
They are, Jiang says, around a bite of sandwich. He's spread out his lunch and papers across Ye Mingjue's desk like he owns it. It's actually kind of nice, seeing Ye Mingjue's desk restored to its usual covered in food and paper state. It makes his absence less glaring somehow.
As far as I know, they went no contact as soon as Wen Ying turned 18 and never looked back. So why hasn't she reported Wen Ying missing? Why is she telling everyone he's somewhere else?
Wen Qing had sat calmly in her apartment and lied to his and Ye Mingjue's faces for half an hour. He remembers thinking at the time that she was a good liar, but obviously he needs to revise his evaluation of her upward. She's a fantastic liar.
Jiang shakes his head. Nobody knows that what the Wens are capable of better than Wen Qing. If there's a threat to her brother, she'd take it seriously. Serious like a nuclear bomb. She doesn't trust anybody else to handle things, especially not the cops. She always thinks she has to do everything herself.
He grimaces.
One of the many things she and my brother have in common.
If the Wens threaten Wen Ying to get Wei Bishan to help them.
If the Wens threaten Wen Ying, Wei Bishan would be falling all over himself to help him. He'd build them all the computers in the world, or whatever they want him for. Joke's on them, though, he scoffs. They could have just grabbed any rando off the street and Wei Bishan would be busting in to save the day. That is, like, his signature move. They could have left Wen Ying and Wen Qing out of it entirely.
What if, when you help somebody, but you make everything else worse? What if everything you do just makes it worse?
How well do you know Wen Qing? Wang Ji asks.
Jiang grimaces.
We dated for, like, a minute in high school.
Wang Ji knows that he doesn't have any room to judge anyone who only hangs out with the same five people they've known since high school. He also really does not want to hear any more about Jiang Wenyin's high school experience.
Have you stayed in touch?
I mean, sort of. She's my brother's roommate, but we don't, like, hang out.
Where could she be?
Honestly, fucking anywhere.
She's a law-abiding person, but she's still a Wen. She's cagey as fuck, and she knows all their tricks. But for my money, she was probably just sitting in her apartment with the lights off, waiting for you to go away. I could go by again this evening. You could. Jiang finishes his sandwich and rolls the wrapper into a ball. But if she doesn't answer the door, we don't have a warrant, and we won't get one before Monday. Wang Ji sighs. That leaves the Wens. Jiang hands him a folder. I tracked down as many of their real estate holdings as I could find, including those held under known aliases or by known associates. Since we know Shui Yang is involved, that means this whole project, whatever it is probably being run by Wen Chao's crew. Those are highlighted in blue. It's good work. Jiang might be blunt and quick-tempered, but he's clearly good at what he does. Wang Ji is grudgingly impressed. The color coding makes it easy to pick out the spots run or frequented by Wen Chao's branch of the organization. Jiang has thoughtfully highlighted those areas on a map as well. It would be easy enough to work their way through each location, and if they had unlimited search warrants and a dozen people, they might get through all of them by the end of the month. "What do you want to do?" Jiang asks. "I want to go down to Nightless City, grab Wen Chao by his stupid embroidered shirt front, and demand that he produce Wei Ying before I make him disappear," Wang Ji thinks. He pushes back from his desk. "I want you to think about who you know that Wen Qing might take a call from. Then I want you to call them and ask to borrow their phone," he says out loud. "We need to talk to her." Jiang nods slowly. "I can do that. I need to check in on Nie Mingtui," Wang Ji says. "I'm going to take a walk, text my brother, and try to think of a way we can check all these locations in the next 36 hours. Outside, a fine mist is trying to decide whether it would like to become a light rain. Wang Ji puts the hood up on his jacket and texts Si Chen. "How did the surgery go? Is Nie Mingtui awake?" He strides through the downtown core, weaving his way past people without really looking at them. There's no way they'll be able to search all the places on Jiang's list. With further triage, they could winnow it down to a smaller set of locations, but there are still way too many variables in play. Their best bet, best in this case meaning most likely to yield meaningful results, at this point would be to lean on some members of the Wen organization. It wouldn't have to be Shui Yang or Wen Chao. Any one of the lower-level flunkies who had been in Wen Chao's office would do nicely. In a situation where Wang Ji had the full force of the Seattle PD behind him, he'd already be hauling people in for questioning. But his conversation with Yao that morning made it a dicey proposition, shaky from a jurisdictional level and leaving Wang Ji without much leverage to exert. He would have to hope that whoever he questioned was so scared of the cops that they just rolled over on Wen Chao without putting up a fuss. And he doubts anyone who's met Wen Chao would be more afraid of spending the day in a police questioning room, all he could really threaten someone with, in the absence of anything to arrest them for, than they would be of incurring Wen Chao's wrath. His phone buzzes with a text. Lan Xichen. "Surgery went well. Mingjue is sleeping off the anesthetic. NHS went home to feed his birds, but he'll be back after. Are you coming by later?" Lan Wangji. "I'll try. Tell him hi for me when he wakes up. Do you need anything?" Lan Xichen. "Nope. Meng Yao brought me a cardigan and my grating. I'm all set." So I guess he has a key to the apartment, Wang Ji thinks, but doesn't text. He doesn't love the idea of Meng Yao being there when he and Si Chen aren't, but it is thoughtful of him to look after Si Chen while he's staying with Nie Mingjue, especially since Meng Yao knows Nie Mingjue doesn't like him. With a sigh, he starts heading back towards the station. He's an investigator. Crafting reasonable hypotheses from the available evidence is what he does, what he's been trained to do, and he's good at it. The evidence he's gathered while searching for Wei Ying hasn't led Wang Ji to him yet, but it has led him to another hypothesis, one he finally feels comfortable acknowledging to himself. Wei Ying cares about him, cares for him, maybe even as much as he cares for Wei Ying. "I'm not good for you, not good for anybody." Why hadn't he said anything? Why couldn't he, for once in his life, actually say the things that mattered most? He thinks, "Yes, you are," as though if he thinks it hard enough, he could send the words back in time to Sunday night and make Wei Ying hear them. He's going to find Wei Ying and say those things to him every day for the rest of his life if that's what it takes. When Meng Ji gets back to his desk, Jiang Wenyin is nowhere to be seen, probably off bothering his high school friends to try to borrow their phones. He's not expecting to have much in the way of new messages on a Saturday, but he does have some inter-office mail. Apparently, some judge is also working on the weekend and has just returned the warrant for the RFID card. He gets on the phone to the manufacturer's customer service department, and half an hour of waiting on hold and sending faxes later, he has the name of the company that purchased the card matching that serial number. He's a little disappointed by how unsurprised he is. He sits looking at the card for a while, turning it over in his hands. What he's contemplating is illegal and dangerous. Any evidence he collects will be inadmissible in court. He could lose his job, possibly even face jail time. If he can hear Wei Ying laugh again, he doesn't think he'll mind at all. Carefully, he loads up the evidence for Wei Ying. For Wei Ying's case into the box he's been using to cart it around, and leaves it on Yiming Jue's desk for Jiang to find. He texts Jiang, following a hunch. Let's meet up afterward and I'll fill you in. Jiang texts back. Okay, where/when? Wang Ji suggests a diner in Capitol Hill that he knows has good vegetarian options. See you there around 6. Then he grabs the spare blazer he keeps at work in case of surprise court appearances and stops in the bathroom to slick back his hair, still damp from his walk earlier. This is, without a doubt, the foolhardiest thing he's ever done. All right. Gosh. So seeing the very first line of the next thing, I guess I assumed that the company was the Wen Corporation, but we're about to see. I'm guessing it wasn't. On a Saturday afternoon, the Jin Corps lobby is quiet. Wang Ji can see through the plate glass windows that the receptionist's gleaming high-tech desk is empty, the check-in touchscreen dark. The security guards are still there, though, on either side of the elevator, looking as alert and armed and possibly ex-military as they did when Wang Ji was here yesterday. He pulls out his phone and calls Nie Huaisang. I need to have a conversation in Mandarin, he says in Mandarin. What about? Nie Huaisang asks in Mandarin. Meng Ji feels a rush of affection for Nie Huaisang. Doesn't matter, Meng Ji says. He puts his head down and starts to walk. I guess you could still speak English if you want. Okay, Nie Huaisang says. So what are you doing? Looking busy and Chinese? Yes, that's correct, Meng Ji says a little more forcefully, getting closer to his cop voice. He barely slows down to open the doors. Ming Jue's surgery went well, Nie Huaisang offers. Yes. Yes, Si Chen already told me that. Wang Ji barks into the phone. He heads briskly past the reception desk, bypassing the guest entrance with its metal detector to head directly to the employee entrance with its electronic gate. What are you doing to follow up? He demands. Nie Huaisang laughs. You sound very important, Lan Losha. I know. He pulls out the RFID card like he's barely even thinking about it, like he does this every day, and scans it. The electronic gate slides upward. He's through. The security guards are watching him, but they haven't moved from their posts. He's going to have to do some physical therapy, Nie Huaisang says. I feel sorry for whoever gets that job. Good, that's good, Wang Ji says. Quick reader's break here. Sorry to be taking a reader's break here, but I was actually refused entry to my office today because I didn't have an access card. An access card which, by the way, nobody in my department has ever heard of. And I think there's going to be some conversation about that going forward. Anyway, I mean, I don't think I could have brazened it through. I don't think there's any languages I speak that the security people don't speak, so wouldn't have worked, but I'm impressed. I feel the value of access cards, especially when nobody has ever told you that you might need one. Okay. He gives the security guards a distracted nod as he walks past them and scans the badge again. The elevator lights up, and he selects the button marked 17th floor, sales. The doors slide open. I have to go, I'm about to get on an elevator, he says. I'll call you back later. Have fun storming the castle, Ye Huaisang says cheerily and hangs up. Quick reader's break. Again, I'm not gonna do this much, but I just watched Princess Bride with my niece a couple of months ago, and it was great. Okay. Jin Sichuan's office has a fantastic view of the water. There's a wedding photo on his desk, and another one of him and Jiang Yanli cradling baby Jin Ling and gazing at each other with bewildered happiness. There's nothing at all to suggest any kind of wrongdoing, on his or Jin Kor's part. His computer password is written on a post-it stuck under his desk. His email is full of meeting alerts, notifications from Jin Kor's customer relationship management system, and not much else. Meng Ji's not surprised, if he's honest with himself. It made sense to check him out, but Wei Ying's brother-in-law didn't seem like the type to get involved in some kind of mob conspiracy. And if he did, he'd probably have the self-preservation instinct to leave his wife's brother well out of it. Maybe Jin Sichuan just dropped his keycard, and Wei Ying was keeping it to give it back to him, Meng Ji thinks. But if that was all there was to it, why was the card so carefully hidden inside Wei Ying's flute case? For that matter, why hadn't Wei Ying had the card on him when he disappeared, since he'd been on his way to Jin Sichuan's house? He heads back to the elevator, contemplating his next move. From what Meng Yao has said about his father, Jin Guangshan, Meng Ji is willing to bet that Jin Kor wouldn't be involved in a secret project with the Wens without the CEO's knowledge and involvement. He tries the key card, but the elevator won't take him up to the floors labeled Executive Suite. He spins the card in his hand, considering, then punches the button for Human Resources. The card programming machine is at the desk closest to the elevators, which makes sense. At a company this big, people must constantly be getting hired or fired or losing their keycards. While he's waiting for it to boot up, he tells himself, there are hundreds of people at this company. Just because you dislike him doesn't mean it's him. Just because you think it's him doesn't mean it's him. It could be anyone. He scans the card, and the company profile associated with it pops up. Jonathan Meng, Director of Operations, 5th Floor. Meng Yao's office has no dazzling views. It looks out into the windows of the building across the street. Meng Ji knows he's not going to find any computer passwords on post-its here. Meng Yao is far too careful for that. There are no pictures on the desk of any kind, for which Meng Ji is thankful. He's not sure he could stomach seeing a picture of his brother cuddled up to Meng Yao right now. He slides on some gloves and gets to work. The drawers are full of pens and paperwork, all normal, boring office stuff, as far as Meng Ji can tell. The filing cabinet is locked. Meng Ji frowns at it, heart pounding so hard he can hear his blood in his ears in the quiet office. He's already breaking and entering. He's already conducting a warrantless search. Wei Ying is in danger. Every moment he spends here increases the likelihood he'll be caught. He only hesitates a moment before grabbing a pen and a paperclip off of the desk and starting to pick the lock. It's been a while since the lockpicking seminar he took, but the filing cabinet lock is small and relatively simple, and he pops it open after a couple of minutes of careful fiddling. Meng Yao's files are meticulous, organized, color-coded. His handwriting is so neat it could practically be a font. There's nothing. Nothing but expense reports and Gantt charts and revenue forecasting models. Nothing, nothing, nothing in all three drawers. The bottom drawer is oddly difficult to slide back into the cabinet. It clunks awkwardly. Wang Ji has to lift it and wiggle it a little to get it to slide in. He slides it back out, frowning again. He reopens the middle drawer, which slides out like it's been greased. Both drawers are full of hanging files. The bottom drawer doesn't seem to have enough extra paper in it for how much heavier it is. He selects a file at random, Expense Reports Q3 2018, and pulls it out from the bottom drawer, pulling one from the middle drawer to compare the weights. The file from the bottom drawer is no heavier or more full than the one from the middle drawer, but it is about 3/4 inch shorter. Both folders are the standard letter size width they'd need to be to fit in the cabinet, but whereas the folder from the middle drawer is about 9.5 inches deep, leaving about 1 inch of clearance between the top of the papers inside and the top of the folder, the folder from the bottom drawer is just barely taller than the papers it contains. He can see, now that he's looking for it, that all of the folders in the bottom drawer have this same characteristic. The edges of the papers inside are a little rumpled, a little frayed, from rubbing up so close to the tops of the folders they're in. He slides the folder from the middle drawer back into its spot, careful not to disrupt Meng Yao's meticulous filing system, then lifts the folders from the bottom drawer in groups, taking that same care to preserve the order they were in. The bottom of the drawer is black plastic. He presses on it, and it gives way a little. There's a space between the bottom of the inside of the drawer and the bottom of the outside. He keeps pressing around the edges until he feels something underneath to press with a click, and the bottom of the drawer comes up in his hand. The space under the false drawer bottom is lined with a soft material, presumably to keep the contents from rattling around. There's an external hard drive, a burner phone, and a stack of envelopes, a couple on Nightless City letterhead, the rest just plain white. Each envelope contains the generic black thumb drive, sometimes two. On the front of each envelope is scrawled the same message. XOXO, XY. The stack of envelopes is rattling. Meng Ji realizes that it's because his hands are visibly, uncontrollably shaking. Sorry, this is a really bad time to have to take a break, but there's some very strange noises happening. I guess they've stopped. Sounded like somebody drilling in my building, which would be extremely unusual at 9:30. Okay. He sets the envelopes down, puts his hands on his knees, and breathes, his vision briefly overwhelmed by spots of blooming, sparkling black. When the spots clear, he's still staring into the drawer, but for a moment his brain can't even process what he's looking at. There's nothing in him, no thought, no reason, just pulsing waves of red-black rage, a startling violence that he hadn't known could even live in his body. He breathes in and out again. He acknowledges his fear and anger. He breathes in calm and quiet, and breathes out the storm inside him, until it is present but no longer controlling him. He tells himself, sternly, that he's not allowed to vomit into Meng Yao's file drawer. Meng Yao's computer is password protected, but that doesn't prevent Meng Ji from using it under a guest profile. He expects the thumb drives to be password protected as well, but they're not. The first drive he accesses has a few folders, all of images. Guns at first. Handguns and semi-automatic pistols. Off-brand variants and clones of M16 and AK-47 rifles. Even grenade launchers. In groups of 1 or 10 or 50. In the next folder, boxes of ammunition. Hollow point rounds. Grenades nestled neatly into their packing boxes. Mostly from Chinese manufacturers. A few Russian. A few Wang Ji doesn't immediately recognize. The next drive just has numbers. A table of 16-digit numbers, each with a month and year associated with it, makes Meng Ji blink for a minute before he realizes that it must be credit card numbers and expiration dates. Another folder is just a massive dump of thousands of email addresses, usernames, and passwords. All the drives are like this. Images of weapons, personal information, tables of prescription drugs. A veritable smorgasbord of illegal items. He's expecting the hard drive to be more of the same, but on a larger scale. Instead, he finds balance sheets, routing numbers, incorporation documents. The specifics are way too complicated for Wang Ji to be able to parse, but put together, they tell a pretty clear story. Money is carefully cleansed through a series of shell companies and fictional enterprises, then funneled into Gene Corps' coffers through various channels, in amounts too small to attract notice individually, but adding up to a sizable sum in aggregate. Working quickly, the back of his neck prickling every moment with the fear he'll be apprehended. Meng Ji accesses his private FTP server and begins copying the files from the hard drive to his home computer. He's not foolish enough to store illegally obtained evidence on his work machine. If he hasn't found Wei Ying by Monday, he can tip Hoffman off about the keycard. Hopefully the prospect of a big corporate bust will be enough to motivate major crimes to search Meng Yao's office. They can find all of this evidence for themselves, legally this time. Otherwise, at least he'll have the financial evidence, which won't be admissible in court, but could easily be leaked to the media. The burner phone doesn't have any contacts saved in it, but Meng Yao clearly hasn't been as careful as he should have been about deleting the text history. The most recent exchange is from last night. The burner phone received a text from an unlisted number saying, "We have N in sight." The burner phone had sent back, "Proceed." The timestamp matches up with Nie Mingjue's hit and run. Wang Ji sets his jaw, and the maelstrom of anger in his chest goes white and still and stone cold. He forces himself to be careful, to be slow and considered and thorough, as he packs everything back into the drawer, placing everything back exactly where it had been. The dismantled pen and bent paperclip he shoves into his pocket, not wanting to leave them in the wastebasket to possibly be found. He clears the history from the guest profile on Meng Yao's computer and slips out of the building, not giving the security guards a second glance as he exits. It's almost time to meet up with Jiang Wenyin. As he walks back towards his car, Wang Ji pulls out his phone and dials Nie Huaisang once more.
Lan Laoshi, how was your secret mission?
I need you to do something for me, no questions asked, Wang Ji says. Hang on, Nie Huaisang says. Wang Ji can hear him say to someone else, muffled, I'm going to take this outside. There's a short interlude of rustling. Okay, Nie Huaisang says, go. Two things, actually. Wang Ji amends himself, thinking fast, trying to keep from breaking into a run as he hurries along the sidewalk. First, I need you to tell Nie Mingjue that our hypothesis about the accident was correct, and that he needs to make Spencer put someone on his door. There's a pause as his friend absorbs the information that his brother might be in need of police protection, but Nie Huaisang has always held no questions asked to be a sacred bond. Done, he says. What else? Wang Ji opens the door to his car, swings inside. Keep Si Chen with you, he says. There's an instant, a tiny fraction of a second where his eyes sting and his throat closes at the thought of his brother, but he shakes it off impatiently. Don't let him go back to our apartment. Keep him at the hospital if you can, or if nothing else, make him come home with you. Make up an excuse. You're better at those sorts of details. Nie Mingjue clears his throat. True? Whatever happens, don't let him go home. And don't let him go anywhere with Meng Yao, no matter what he says. Okay, I won't. Wang Ji breathes out a heavy sigh. Breathes? You know, sometimes. Wang Ji breathes out a heavy sigh, trying to force his heartbeat to slow down. He closes his eyes. Thanks, Didi. Wang Ji, I promise I will explain everything as soon as I can.
I'll hold you to that,
Nie Huaisang laughs a little unsteadily. He arrives at the diner a few minutes before six and doesn't see Jiang anywhere. Fortunately, the dinner rush hasn't really gotten going yet. He's able to request a booth at the very back of the long, narrow space, where he can sit with his back to the wall and watch the door. Jiang probably won't like sitting with his back to the room. Most cops don't. But Wang Ji's nerves are still jangling from his foray into corporate espionage, and he needs something solid at his back if he's going to keep from jumping out of his skin. The server brings him a glass of water, which he drains gratefully, and a cup of terrible, burnt-tasting tea. Jiang strides in a few minutes later, exuding a restless, irascible energy, like he has a bee in his classically elegant fall coat. He scowls when he sees that Wang Ji has left him the seat facing away from the door, but sinks into it without comment. No luck getting a hold of Wen Qing, he says, without preamble. I had a hard enough time tracking down anyone who's still in touch with her, and when I did, she still wasn't picking up the phone. Wang Ji sips his tea, watching as Jiang adjusts his shirt cuffs, straightens his tie, fidgets around in his chair, and with a final burst of cranky energy, snaps open the menu. In a way, it's almost soothing. The annoyance he feels at Jiang Wenyin's mannerisms is refreshingly grounded in the everyday. The server, perhaps sensing the presence of an impatient rich person, appears next to their table as if by magic. Jiang orders blueberry pancakes, sausage, and scrambled eggs. Meng Ji's stomach is feeling weak and shaky after the events of the last 24 hours, so he just orders a fruit cup and a bowl of oatmeal. Quick reader's break. I didn't realize it was 6 in the morning. That makes more sense. Okay, that makes sense now. I'm following. I heard you were uptight, Lan, but I didn't think that meant... Oh, maybe not. Lies. I heard you were uptight, Lan, but I didn't think that meant you actually ate gruel for dinner, Jiang scoffs. So, readers, nope, it is dinner time. Sorry, they're just both having breakfast for dinner, which is fair. I love breakfast for dinner. I mean, not a bowl of unflavored oatmeal, but... Wang Ji doesn't feel the need to dignify that with a response. So, what did you get up to this afternoon? Jiang asks. Did your hunch pan out?
Taking another sip of his tea, Meng Ji makes and holds eye contact.
Before we proceed, I should remind you that this is officially a major crimes case now. Neither of us is supposed to be working on it.
Jiang straightens up in his seat a little.
I know.
I make it my practice not to lie, Wang Ji says. But it would, perhaps, be for the best if you did not inquire as to how I obtained the information I'm about to share with you.
Noted, Jiang says slowly.
Wang Ji tells him about what he found in Meng Yao's office, carefully avoiding any details about how he got into the building or how he knows Meng Yao in the first place. If there's any way he can keep Si Chen's name out of this, he's going to do it.
Jiang, who is clearly less familiar with the doctrine of no questions asked than Nie Huaisang is, interrupts him several times to ask things like, how did you even get past security?
Each time, Meng Ji simply closes his mouth and waits, silent, until he's sure Jiang is going to let him continue. By the time he finishes his report, they're both equal parts upset by the information and irritated with each other.
Gene Core, Jiang says, shaking his head. He takes a ruminative bite of pancake.
I'd say I can't believe it, but I'm actually having very little trouble believing it.
Could Jin Zixuan?
No, Jiang cuts him off.
No way he's involved.
I know he's your brother-in-law, but...
Meng Ji tactfully leaves the sentence unfinished.
Yeah, and you also know I barely even liked the guy, Jiang points out. But I still don't think he'd be involved in something like this. Even if he was, he's not smart enough to keep it a secret from my sister.
Thinking of Jin Zixuan's vacuous smile, Meng Ji is inclined to agree.
So what? Jiang says. Gene Corps gets this stuff into the country, the Wens sell it?
Meng Ji nods.
Perhaps. But sell to whom? They wouldn't be moving goods in such mass quantities without a buyer in mind. Who would be in the market for such a wide array of illegal goods?
They eat, tossing ideas back and forth, jotting down notes, debating each other. It's not as easy or productive as it would have been with Nie Mingjue, and every time Wang Ji thinks about that, the frigid rage in his gut drops another several degrees. But it's still helpful to have another person to bounce things off of. Even as the brainstorming focuses his mind and the oatmeal soothes his stomach, though, Wang Ji can't quite relax, can't keep from jumping at every loud noise, can't keep from looking up every time someone comes through the door. Which is why he doesn't miss it when, just as they're finishing their meal, the ghost of the man he loves walks in. Wei Ying is pale. His step is slow and measured, so different from the way he usually bounces and lopes and saunters around. His face is closed off, guarded, but it's him. Jiang is signing the check and carping about something or other, so absorbed in his complaints that he doesn't notice that Wang Ji is frozen to the spot. Doesn't notice anything until Wei Ying quietly sits down in the chair next to him. Jiang looks up and is also frozen. The two of them gape at Wei Ying, who turns to look straight at his brother, ignoring Wang Ji entirely. After a long, shocked moment, Jiang is the first to recover. He pulls Wei Ying into a fierce hug, squeezing his eyes tightly shut. Wei Ying stiffens, but brings one hand up to tentatively pat Jiang Wenyan's back. Pulling back from the hug, Jiang takes a moment to compose himself, then turns and punches Wei Ying viciously in the arm.
What the hell happened to you?
Wei Ying smiles, a fractured little half-smile that doesn't touch his eyes.
Hello to you too, little brother, he says quietly.
He's still refusing to so much as glance at Wang Ji, which at least gives Wang Ji the stance to study him, probably the chance to study him, to take in every inch of his dear, longed-for face, to scrutinize him for hurt and harm. He's thinner than he was 6 days ago, the bones of his wrists and clavicles standing out more sharply than they usually do. There are deep purple hollows under his eyes, and unshaven shadows on his chin. His skin is dull. His hair is lank and greasy, hanging limply in a loose ponytail down his back. He's wearing a black button-down shirt that Wang Ji's never seen before, and it fits him oddly, straining tight across his shoulders, the unbuttoned cuffs leaving a good half inch of his wrists bare. A half-healed cut ladders up his lower lip. But he's here. He's alive, and he's right here, and Wang Ji wants nothing more than to touch him, to pull him close and smell his skin and feel his heartbeat, to reassure himself that this isn't a dream, but Wei Ying still won't look at him,
and Wang Ji will not betray himself in front of Jiang Wenyin until he understands more about what's going on.
You look like hell, Jiang observes in typical Jiang fashion. Where the fuck have you been?
Wei Ying smiles that broken smile again and ducks his head. The light catches his cheekbone, and Wang Ji can see that there is a large, days-old bruise blooming there, fading greens and browns darkening to mottled purple at the center, another greening bruise darkening the corner of his jaw.
Would you believe I got mugged? He asks. Some guys jumped me coming out of work on Monday.
Aji has been beside herself, Jiang says, as though he and Wang Ji have not also been beside themselves.
Why didn't you call her?
They took my phone. I haven't had a chance to get a new one, Wei Ying says carefully. I've been staying with a friend of a friend while I recuperated. An insincere flash of teeth, which Jiang seems to completely buy.
God damn it, Wei Wuxian. We've been all over the city looking for you, Jiang grumbles,
but he's looking more and more mollified by the second.
Wang Ji wants to scream, wants to reach across the table and throttle him because something is wrong. Something is clearly wrong. Nothing about this is right. But Wei Ying's mere presence seems to have satisfied Jiang that there's nothing more to worry about.
You do have a tendency to overreact, Jiang Qiang, Wei Ying says evenly. There's no need.
You've been staying with a friend of a friend? Wang Ji asks sharply. Who?
Wei Ying turns to look at him for the first time. And his eyes are glittering, dangerous, a razor's well-honed edge. Ah, yes, Detective Lan, he says in a cold, detached voice that sets Wang Ji's teeth on edge. I must apologize for inconveniencing you, but as you can see, there's nothing to investigate.
And you're okay? Jiang asks, elbowing him,
relief shading into a sort of jocular, brotherly roughhousing. Wei Ying raises his chin.
I'm fine, he says firmly. I must ask that you come down to the station and give a statement, Wang Ji says, privately thinking, if I can just get him alone, away from Jiang Wenyin, maybe he'll tell me the truth.
That won't be necessary, Wei Ying says. His smile is polite, distant, dismissive.
It's the smile you give a passing acquaintance who's done something overly familiar, when you're too polite to call them out on it.
Really, Detective Lan, I'm not sure what more you want from me. I heard that you were looking for me. Here I am. I'm not missing. I'm right here. He looks at Wang Ji as though they mean nothing to each other. It stings. It burns.
I don't think he needs to come down to the station, Jiang Wenyin adds. We've both seen him. That should be enough to close the missing persons case. But I expect a full report from you later, he says, pointing a finger in Wei Ying's face.
Wei Ying turns away from Wang Ji again, disregarding him entirely.
Of course, later, he tells Jiang Wenyin. I have to go. I just saw you through the window, and I thought I would come in and tell you to call off the hunt. Please apologize to Ajia for me, and tell her I'll call her when I can. Tell her yourself, Jiang retorts.
Wei Ying smiles, and this one almost looks real.
Maybe I will.
He pats Jiang on the shoulder, pushes back from the table, and turns to walk out. Wang Ji is so stunned by his sudden appearance and his odd behavior that he almost lets him go. A part of him is already trying to protect himself, telling himself that he'd simply gotten too invested in a casual friendship, that he should drop the whole thing before he embarrasses himself further. He remembers the bunny drawings, the tender affection with which Wei Ying had sketched his face, and scowls. Wei Ying is almost to the door of the diner by the time Wang Ji catches up to him.
Wei Ying, Wang Ji calls urgently.
Wei Ying stops, his back to Wang Ji, and seems to consider not turning around. He does, though, that patient, tolerant, dead-eyed smile still on his face. Detective Lan?
What's really going on?
Wang Ji asks, looking searchingly into Wei Ying's eyes.
You can tell me.
You know you can. I already told you everything, Wei Ying says. His face betrays nothing, no emotion at all. There's nothing more to say. Now, unless I'm under arrest for something, I assume I'm free to go? He turns to leave.
Wait.
Wang Ji reaches out and grabs his forearm, intending to turn Wei Ying back towards him. Wei Ying jumps, sucking in a breath through his teeth as though in pain, and jerks his arm out of Wang Ji's grasp. He tugs the sleeve of his too small shirt, pulling it as far down his arm as he can, but not before Wang Ji can see the red marks on the soft underside of his arm, several of them, each raised and shiny and perfectly round. Wang Ji raises his eyes back to Wei Ying's, and for a moment Wei Ying's mask slips, and Wang Ji can see pain and fear and a terrible sadness in his eyes. "Stop looking for me, Lan Chan," Wei Ying says softly. He turns and walks out of the restaurant, not looking back. Wang Ji watches him through the front window as he walks away. He only makes it a few steps before a black sedan pulls up to the curb. The front of the car is crumpled in on the driver's side, the headlight shattered, the paint scraped. Wen Julio, or whatever his actual name is, gets out of the back seat and holds the door open for Wei Ying like a chauffeur. Wei Ying, his mouth set in a rigid line, gets into the back seat, and Wen Julio gets in after him. Wang Ji narrows his eyes, trying to get a look at the driver, who's wearing a baseball cap and sunglasses. The driver sees him looking and blows him a kiss, wiggling his fingers in a coquettish little wave that shows off his prosthetic finger. The car peels away from the curb. Wang Ji stands there, seething, thinking about Nie Mingjue's collarbone and Si Chen's soon-to-be broken heart, Xiao Xing Chen's haunted eyes, but above all, Wen Chao chain-smoking in his office. The cigarette burns on Wei Ying's arm, the bruises on his face. Wang Ji clenches his hands into fists. "Fuck," he whispers. Others end notes. This chapter is accompanied by donations to the Northwest Community Bail Fund and to Life After Hate. There's a Tumblr post making the rounds that asks something like, if you could let Lan Wangji say fuck one time in the series, where would it be? I decided going into writing this that Wangji was going to say fuck one time in this fic, and this is the spot I chose. Reader's note. Incredibly valid. Incredibly. Thanks, as always, to Spoops and Ericacia. Maybe I should just go back and forth since I don't know how to pronounce this one either. Ericacia or Ericacia. For continued betaing, yelling, cheerleading about this story. And thanks to all of you for reading and commenting. I love seeing your reactions to each new chapter. I made another fan vid, a Shui Xiao one this time. If you're into that, check it out. And there's a link to the Tumblr. Coming next week in Chapter 8, Return to Nightless City. End of the chapter. Okay, well, he's alive. We know he's alive, so that's nice. I feel good about that. I don't feel necessarily super confident about his continued existence, especially given that Shui Yang and Wen Julio clearly know he just talked to Lan Wangji. That's alarming. I mean, clearly they must have dropped him off to tell them to stop doing the missing persons case, but I will be concerned. Certainly, I'm not saying that it's impossible I will read another chapter tonight. How long is the next chapter? It's not the longest ever, but we'll see. I am cliffhung. So let's all cross our fingers for Wei Ying, and I will talk to you again soon. Bye.